Hello and welcome to issue 48 of Double Reel, the monthly magazine podcast for the discerning film nerd. It's April 2024 and the clocks have gone forward, but everything else seems to be going backwards. We're here to help you get through the month with a big helping of cinematic content for your waiting ears. My name's James Adamson and I'm a film nerd with a geeky love of film and obscure stories from the world of cinema and a lot of opinions. Joining me on the podcast is my co-host, also called James Adamson. Welcome, James.
Hello, it is good to be back.
We aim to provide you with the podcast equivalent of the monthly film magazines you used to buy in the newsagent, packed with a range of features from the world of film. We divide each monthly issue into three parts, which we release a week at a time to keep your feed fed through the month.
This is the first part of the episode, Double Reel Monthly. We'll look at recent film news, what new releases are heading our way, and review any new films we've seen since the last episode. We'll also discuss how we're getting on with the film-related resolutions we've made for 2024.
Next week we'll deliver our regular features, Classics and Recommended, Hidden Gem, The One That Got Away and the remake Hate Watch.
The following week it'll be the big conversation where we talk about a topic from the world of film in more detail. We'll tell you more about that later, and there are more details about all of our features on our various social media channels.
If you want to check that out or comment on the podcast, you can find us on Twitter on @DoubleRealFilm. There's also an Instagram account called Double Reel Podcast and a Double Reel Podcast Facebook page for you to follow if you're that way inclined. You can follow us on letterboxd.com/doublereel, where we list all the films we've discussed in the podcast and much more besides. You can also find the Double Reel podcast on the new social media platforms Blue Sky, Threads and Mastodon. If you like the podcast, we'd also be very grateful if you could leave a review on Apple, Spotify or whichever platform you use, as it really helps us get the word out to the rest of the world.
Now it's time to dim the lights and take your seats for our latest Double Reel Monthly. Hope you enjoy it.
Let's get into it. Double Reel Monthly is the first part of the episode and gives you a regular digest of news, new releases and how we've been fitting in movie watching with our busy, exciting lives. In the next hour and a bit, you'll get a breakdown of what's going on in the world of film this month and we'll set you up for your own movie watching. As well as that, at the start of each year, we make some film-related New Year's resolutions, so we'll be discussing the goals we've set for ourselves in 2024. As always, our mission is to give you a great discussion about films and film-related stories that will inspire you to escape the confines of the algorithm and watch something you haven't seen or have been meaning to see for a better cinematic experience. Also, just to quickly mention our other podcast, which you might like to check out, The Adamsons Versus is where we step away from the world of film and talk about stories, news and anything else that's caught our attention. Our most recent episode, The Adamsons Versus the Dog Poo Detectives, is out now and we're planning to bring you a new episode soon. With that piece of self-promotion out of the way, let's look at some messages we received from listeners. Stuart, one of our regulars, gets in touch about last month's issue. Pretty much agreed with your assessment of Audition. It's made me fancy watching it again, so I've put it on. Did you know Takashi Miike has a cameo in Hostel? Is he only in it for 5 seconds, though, as a Japanese businessman? I did not know that. I'm not sure I want to sit through Hostel again just for that. I might YouTube it. Tony, friend of the pod, also reached out. I thought he'd exaggerated the plot deficiencies of Madame Web, so I checked more details online. What a shit show. Tony also shares a very funny YouTube video imagining the pitch meeting for the film. Check it out. Just go on YouTube and go for Madame Web pitch meeting. It's a completely accurate description of how that meeting must have gone down. We'll be discussing new film Immaculate later, and Dom says this sucked more than any other film so far this year. Some very gross scenes, every old trope in the book, and added nothing new. Shannon, on the other hand, said, I like this, well made with some decent scares. Chloe's even more enthusiastic. I'm not particularly fond of religious horror, but this was a breath of fresh air. Some clear homages to 70s horror, but it had its own brutal, uncompromising style, and Sydney Sweeney kills it. We're also catching up on The Beekeeper, and Carl says Jason Statham is just a low-rent Bruce Willis wannabe. The fact they sneak this out in January tells you everything you need to know about how shit it is, which is quite... Get off the fence, Kyle. We'll also be discussing Roadhouse briefly, the remake. Rona says, I was enjoying this until Conor McGregor showed up. There's bad acting and then there's this. I've no idea why they cast him in it. Jake Gyllenhaal is pretty watchable, but this is still a subpar film. I'm not really a fan of the original, but it was better than this. Jesse, more favourable. People shouldn't try to pretend the original is some kind of untouchable classic. I love it, but it's far from perfect. The remake captured a lot of the big, dumb fun of the Patrick Swayze version. Of course, it's not as good as the original, but I enjoyed it and I'd watch it again. Later on my resolution, I'll be discussing Lady Bird, and Rona says, despite my best efforts to like this movie, it was underwhelming and somewhat boring. I didn't even bother to finish it. I didn't think it was particularly groundbreaking. I feel that I've seen this type of coming-of-age film a million times. The main character, Lady Bird, annoyed the shit out of me. She was so unlikable. Dell with a more favourable view. I liked it. The story is fairly familiar, but it's the great performances that make it. Monty says, terrific film. The characters and story really resonated with me. Thanks, as always, for your messages. It's always good to hear from you. Let us know what you think of this month's episode. Now on with the pod. Just a quick announcement. We've decided to make some just sort of changes to kind of streamline the quiz, streamline the podcast. Freudian slip there. We're not going to do the quiz anymore. As much as we enjoy it, it does take up a lot of time, and there is a lot of just, you know, the two of us hubbing and hawing trying to answer quiz questions. It's not the most dynamic. So we've dropped that out. Just, you know, you can imagine a lot of, you know, it takes a lot of time to kind of fit everything in. And also, we'll mention this again on the next reel, but this will be the last month that we do a One That Got Away. I think we probably mind that. We're not running out of remakes and not running out of classics and hidden gems, but we are running a little bit dry on the One That Got Away, so we're going to drop that out. Always like to keep things fresh, but that's what we're doing.
It's more of a just kind of streamline it, because I was listening to Kermode and Mayo the other day, and I realised every single one of their episodes is about an hour long.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that we are, you know, we are committing to, you know, a 3.5 hour is, you know, a lot. It is like a magazine, really.
I mean, yeah, and it's like turning into a bit of an epic. So we're just going to try and make it a bit more streamlined. And like, you know, easier for, like you said, mate, easier for people to listen to as well. Okay, so the first thing we always cover on Double Room Monthly is the news. Has any news caught your eye, mate?
I think it's been a bit of a quiet month, this one. I keep seeing things about Bruce Willis, which is making me very unhappy. But as we're recording this morning, actually, Margot Robbie's company is going to produce a film. Do you know what it's about?
This is Monopoly, isn't it?
It is Monopoly, yes.
I bet you she's not in that and doesn't play any large part in it, but if it's going to happen, she doesn't mind her production company being the one that makes a bit of money out of it.
If she plays the Monopoly man, then that is range. But that'll be interesting. I mean, everyone kind of scoffed at Barbie, so, you know, we'll...
Yeah, I do wonder, though, you know, everything's a product film these days, isn't it? You know, probably the nadir so far has been the Flaming Hot Cheetos one. It's like, come on.
Nah, that can fuck off. But we liked Barbie.
And yeah, yeah.
They also, they're doing this one, so...
Never write off Margot Robbie, right?
I would rather see a film about Monopoly than another Marvel film or a live-action Disney remake, so I'm fine with this.
Yeah, fair enough. A couple of obituaries, probably more meaning for people of my generation. Emma Walsh died aged 88.
Christ.
234 acting credits to his name, probably most famous for being in Blade Runner... and Blood Simple, the Coen brothers' debut film. Roger Ebert liked Emmett Walsh so much that he coined the Stanton Walsh rule, which is any film that has Harry Dean Stanton or Emmett Walsh in the cast can't be all bad, except for Wild Wild West. That was the one exception. Lou Gossett Jr. has passed away at the age of 87. 212 acting credits to his name. These are sort of real solid character actors who just, you know, working actors who, you know, never stop, really. He won the Oscar for Best Supporting Actor in Officer and a Gentleman. He was also in stuff like The Deep, Iron Eagle, the original series of Roots, and Jaws 3D. He's one of those people who would turn up in most things, and he's watchable even if Jaws 3 isn't. any other news?
Actually, I did want to talk about this. This is quite sad, but he's not a very well known actor, but it was he's a Native American actor called Cole Brings Plenty. That's obviously his traditional Native American name. He passed away at the age of 27, same age as me.
Oh, blimey.
They said there's no indication of foul play. He was in Yellowstone, so he's not like a big film actor, but obviously it's nice to kind of just, you know, pay respects to people that have, you know, died, especially when they're this young. So it looks, don't know, don't want to speculate, but it doesn't look like there's foul play, but, it, you know, it's obviously still a very sad moment for his friends and family.
Yeah, RIP to him, definitely.
But news, moving on from maybe onto some less kind of sad stuff.
Well, there is a little bit of news that Coppola's new film Megalopolis is going to debut at the Cannes Film Festival, but it is still struggling to find a distributor. Francis Ford Coppola has put $100+ million of his own money into this film.
He must be skint now.
He basically sold off part of his wine business, which is worth like $500 million.
Oh, well, that's fine then.
But honestly, he's the kind of crazy person who in his 80s will stick $100 million of his own money into making a movie that what people have said is I love it, but it's too random. It's like it's not going to be a blockbuster. And it's like, well, anyone else would have made that movie for $5 million, but not Coppola. So it's all, I mean, he's been trying to make this film for like 40 odd years. I'm curious to see it. So it's just a question of how and when it comes out, really.
The only notable, I suppose, news for myself is that the trailer for Joker Folie à Deux, I don't know how to pronounce that, Folie à Deux, has been released.
Yeah.
Looks very interesting. But I'm scrolling through Empire's news here, and it's just kind of like articles. There's two Zack Snyder articles, too many.
There's only one last small one that I had written down. I don't know how major this is, but there's a few more shenanigans in the MCU. They've announced apparently that Deadpool 3, which is coming out in about July, is not going to be in the MCU. They're not bringing Deadpool into the MCU.
That would save the MCU. Or maybe actually, do you know what? Do you reckon that's Ryan Reynolds saying, no, I don't want any part of this shit?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, on the one hand, you look at it and say, with James Gunn going off to DC and Deadpool not being interested in canon, which also means that Wolverine and the X-Men aren't coming into the canon. It's almost as if Marvel just don't want to have any good films in the MCU.
Yeah, I mean, there's a guy I work with who's really into his Marvel, mm-hmm. and he just comes into it and he says all this stuff, and he says that apparently what they did with the Loki TV show, where it's like a, you know how they go into the quantum realm and it's an alternate Loki,
mm-hmm.
apparently they want to do that for all the original Avengers.
Yeah.
I don't know how true it is. I don't know if that's just him, you know, speculating, but apparently because it's been such a mess, they want to bring back like Robert Downey Jr. as Iron Man because there was so much success there. Don't know how true it is. It could be utter nonsense, but I think that would be an absolute disaster because they'd end up having to spend all this money on people like Robert Downey Jr. and Chris Evans, and the films would still flop. Maybe they wouldn't flop.
Yeah, but I think they dug themselves a big hole because they went through a period of literally every Marvel film making $1 billion, frankly, no matter what they did. Unfortunately for them, the audience was there and some of the films were very good. But now they're sort of going, I don't think they've managed to get them out of the spiral of, oh, let's just put another Marvel film out. It's like, well, no, you're going to have to actually put some thought into this. So good luck. and they haven't worked that out yet. So the only reason I'm concerned about it, because if MCU's had its day, tough luck. Do you know what I mean? The only thing that worries me is it just seems to be a little bit, it's going to make it difficult for the rest, for the film industry generally, because these blockbusters sucked up all the oxygen, didn't it? It used up all the resources of film distribution. And it's like, well, that's fine, because what happens is that when $1 billion worth of people are coming into the cinema, they might see a trailer for something else, they'll see another film that's on, and it's good overall. But if those films are flopping, can they just get the fuck out of the way, and can something else be the mainstream movie now? Do you know what I mean?
Exactly,
because it's just, it's not good for the cinema if nothing's making any money, but the things that are losing all the money aren't getting out of the way, you know? So that's the only thing that worries me. Because we want some other thing to come and be a shot in the arm, you know?
Yeah.
So that's that. No more news for you?
Just like some new releases. There's been that Christian Bale's going to be playing Frankenstein.
Oh, I did see that.
And then there's a new Star Wars film called Acolyte, and the only thing that looked pretty cool to me is that they've got the guy from Squid Game. I don't know, I can't remember his name. The main guy from Squid Game. It's
yes, I know who you mean. Yeah.
And they've also got a Wookiee that is a Jedi. So that'll be fucking awesome.
Interesting. Yeah, I did see the new Star Wars thing coming.
It's Acolyte, the Star
yes,
Wars
that's right,
Acolyte.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
A live action Moana, if that tickles your peach.
No, really no.
It's yeah. Matrix 5. Okay, yeah, I think that's time to round up the news.
Yeah, I know, they're desperate. But another quiet month for news. Okay, the next thing we talk about is what new releases are coming out. We've decided to tweak this a little bit as well. Rather than just read out names of films, I thought what we could say is, between now and the 25th of May, which is when the next Double Real Monthly comes out, what film is coming out which is really getting you excited, James?
Do you want to go first? Because okay. I'm still undecided about mine.
All right. Well, I'm gonna throw my hat in the ring. Even if I'm nervous, I'm excited about the new Furiosa film.
Right. Yeah. I'll let you have that one.
that comes out on May the 24th. I could be booking myself in for a disappointment here. If I look at it the way I looked at when Mad Max Fury Road came out, when Mad Max Fury Road was announced, and it's like, oh, it's a Mad Max sequel 30 years after the last one which wasn't very good, and it's not Mel Gibson anymore, it's Tom Hardy as Mad Max. I was like, is that going to be any good? Much as I like Tom Hardy, is it all a bit over? And then Mad Max Fury Road is now one of my favourite films of all time. It was an absolute smash. So I sit thinking, well, it's only been 9 years. Anya Taylor-Joy is great. George Miller is, I love George Miller, but it's all like, is this just asking lightning to strike in the same place twice? Are we going to be this lucky this time? But I am excited. Anya Taylor-Joy, Chris Hemsworth, George Miller going for it. I will certainly be there to watch it, and I'm nervous, but I am excited.
Yeah, I think you're just nervous because you absolutely love Fury Road. So for yourself, you're like, oh, am I going to love it as much? I think
yeah, you're just, because I'm going to be really disappointed if it's shit, basically.
I don't think it will. They've taken a lot of time. 9 years is a long time.
Yeah.
Now, I was torn between that, but I figured you were going to say that. So I have gone for Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes.
Yeah, now what's your thought on this?
So, I like you, I'm a little bit apprehensive because we were talking about this not long ago and how it's not actually Matt Reeves. I don't even know if he's involved. Is he maybe producing? I think he's producing. He's not involved at all. Yeah, no, I thought he was a producer, but it's Wes Ball directing it, not Uwe Ball. He's done the Maze Runner films, which were okay. So it's a big project for him to kind of, it's probably like a kind of make or break kind of project for him because the Maze Runner films didn't, you know, blow anyone away, but I just love the previous three so much that.
Yeah. Now the first one wasn't directed by Matt Reeves, so the whole thing doesn't completely depend on Matt Reeves, but I do think they got better as they went along because Matt Reeves added so much. The other thing is the only thing I'd heard of that Matt Reeves had done before he did, the Planet of the Apes films was Cloverfield. Now, Cloverfield is a good film. I actually think it's in a lot of ways underrated. Some people seem to give it like mixed reviews at the time, but I really liked Cloverfield. I went to see it at the cinema.
Yeah.
So, again, are we asking lightning to strike twice? I just wonder, the motivation for making this film is the studio's trying to keep a franchise going. Do you know what I mean? That's my worry. I worry that it's not a case of someone kicked the door in and said, right, stop everything. I've just come up with an absolutely brilliant latest installment in the Planet of the Apes world. We've got to do this. Do you know what I mean? I'm so sceptical that that's really what's happened, you know? What about you? Do you think it's...
Obviously, I do love the previous three. And the third one is my favourite. But I am excited for this one, even if it doesn't have Matt Reeves. And like you say, the first one didn't have Matt Reeves. It's got a solid kind of cast. Freya Allen, who, for anyone who doesn't know, was in the Witcher series.
William H. Macy's in it.
He's always pretty good. And Kevin Durand, who... although it's a terrible film, I quite liked him in X-Men Origins. He played the guy that gets really fat.
And Ika Darville's in it, who was in Jessica Jones. Only a supporting character, but I quite liked him. I don't think he's the person who makes a film on his own, but they've got decent people in roles, yeah?
Well, to be fair, it doesn't really matter who the humans are in this film, does it?
True.
I don't know. You could put anyone. I mean, it's the motion capture.
Isn't that another problem? I don't see Andy Serkis's name involved in this at all.
I mean, spoiler, if you haven't seen these films, spoiler, and you really want to see them, spoiler, Andy Serkis's character, Caesar, dies at the end of the third one. So I assume that it'll probably be his son, or it'll be, you know, following his story. So
I just wonder, if you don't have Andy Serkis's team handling all the motion capture, are you missing one of the things that made the film so special before, you know?
Yeah. I hope not. But I'm still excited for it because they've been so good. I mean, if it's like the Mark Wahlberg one, then, you know, that's my own fault for getting too excited about it. But no, I'm excited for this one.
Yeah. Well, fingers crossed. I mean, that's May the 10th in the UK, I think. May 9th.
Oh, so just I was just reading the trivia there on IMDb. It's 300 years after Andy Serkis's character.
Well, so it's not Son of the Planet. Yeah, it's full on.
Interesting. The director, Wes Ball, pitched it as Apocalypto with apes. So,
well, listen, if he pitched an idea and people got excited, then that there's hope.
Here we go.
So I've my fingers are crossed. Okay. Yeah. So look, we'll put up a post of like what you know the upcoming things. So keep an eye on our socials, and we'll post some other upcoming things. But you know, upcoming films releases. But we thought it'd be better just talk about the ones that we genuinely got an interest in. Yeah. Okay, so that takes us from the films that are coming up that we want to see to the films that we've actually watched this month. Now, what films have you seen since we last spoke on the podcast, mate?
Let me get all the Prime Video and Netflix entries. So I watched one last night because everyone that I know, work, friends, said to watch it, and that was Ricky Stenicki.
Ricky Stenicki.
Have you not heard about this?
I think I have heard of it.
Right, so it's
I'm getting a mental image of a sort of an ensemble, an ensemble kind of poster with. Oh yeah, here we go. Zac Efron and John Cena. I've heard about this, but I don't really know
much
about it.
I'll give it a brief synopsis. So basically, Zac Efron and his friends, when they're young, they're mucking around on Halloween. They decide to kind of. I think they throw a bag of dog shit mm-hmm. into a house, and they end up causing a lot of havoc. The house catches fire, and they think, "Oh fuck, someone's going to catch us. How do we get away with this?" So they leave a jacket at the scene of the crime. They write the name Ricky Stenicki in it, thinking, "Oh, if the police they'll look for someone called Ricky Stenicki who doesn't exist."
Yeah,
and then from them they use this imaginary person to get out of anything.
Right. And obviously it. I bet it turns out Ricky Snicky's a real person and that causes real shit.
No. So I'm going to do this as quickly as possible because I would think people would enjoy it. But basically they use it if they want to get out of going to their cousin's birthday. They just say, oh, fucking Ricky Snicky's just phoned me and he's really not well. He's in a hospital. I need to go see him. And then everyone's like, oh yeah, go see your friend. That's so good that you're going to go see your friend. And it starts with, there's another character played by Andrew Santino, who's like an American comedian. His wife is, you know, fit to birth. She's away to give birth.
Yeah.
She's heavily pregnant. And to get out of the baby shower, they say that Ricky Stenicki's cancer's come back again. And they need to go to New York and see him. And it's to go to like a mad techno concert.
Yeah.
And at that concert, they meet John Cena, who is actually a guy called Rod Reimstead. Now, he does these X-rated kind of like comedy shows, so he does like the best bit of the film is when he sings all these songs from throughout time, but it's all to do with masturbation. So for example, it's White Wedding by Billy Idol is It's a Nice Day for Woodwhacking is the kind of humor that we're going for there. It's very funny, it's very daft, but they come home and they kind of get daubed in and people are getting suspicious and, well, we phoned every hospital in Albany, you know, Andrew Santino's wife, she was away to give, she's given birth and we couldn't get a hold of you. There's no record of any Ricky Stenicki in any of these hospitals. So they go, oh, fuck. So they hire John Cena, who is this absolute liability, alcoholic, X-rated performer, to be Ricky Stenicki.
Yeah.
And they have this Bible where they've written down every story.
And he's got to know it. All right.
So he reads this Bible, takes it seriously, and becomes Ricky Stenicki. And that's the story from there. That's pretty much it. And it's okay. It wasn't, I think, because everyone was saying it was really funny. Without John Cena, it would be terrible. And I never thought I would say that a former WWE wrestler would be so good in a film that without him, the film would be really boring. Because without the film, it would be really boring.
Yeah.
But it is good. It's
Yes, so it sounds like a fun watch if you just stick it on streaming.
Yeah, definitely.
Where's that on?
Prime. So if you've got Prime, you can watch it for free. You don't need to rent it or anything.
Very good.
Do you want to do one while I figure out my next one?
Yeah, so I went to see one film at the cinema. I did want to go and see another one, Monkey Man, but with various things, you know, other sort of commitments that happened this month, I haven't been able to see that quite yet. I'll be going to see that next week and I'll review it next month on the pod. But I did go and see Immaculate at the cinema, which is the new sort of nun horror, religious horror film with Sydney Sweeney.
Okay.
Now, Sydney Sweeney's had quite a part to play in this. She was actually committed to this story. Now, this has sort of some sort of Giallo influences, because although you see a mobile phone later on, other than that, a mobile phone and a computer, but you don't see a lot of technology. So it's got Giallo influences. So it could almost be set at any time. And the colour and style is not quite so Giallo, because if any listeners watch a bit of like Dario Argento, those films are always really like bright red colours, and this is a much more muted colour. It's sort of Name of the Rose, so it's like a Giallo Name of the Rose is how it kind of plays out. It's very atmospheric, it's very creepy. Someone nicknamed it Rosary's Baby, which I thought was quite funny. The idea is that Sydney Sweeney is a young girl, maybe high school age, but late teens or something. She's a devout Catholic from America who's whatever she was in, seminary, convent, whatever they're called in America, closed. And they've basically brought her over to Italy to take her orders as a nun. And she gets pregnant, but, without ever having any sexual contact with anyone. So I think it's a miracle. It's the second coming. Because it's a horror movie, things are actually a lot more sinister than that. There's a lot of weird sort of crazy shit going on. Now, I actually quite like this. I thought Sydney Sweeney was excellent. And I thought it built its atmosphere really well. It didn't rely heavily on jump scares, the kind of, oh, here we go, the usual kind of thing. I thought they actually worked really hard to build like a really creepy, scary atmosphere. And you start to identify to Sydney Sweeney's character. Well, she's really kind of, she's just trapped thousands of miles from home, around these crazy people. What on earth is going on? And by the time the plot reveal comes out, and the plot reveal is a bit crazy, because it's always a bit crazy, isn't it? Do you know what I mean? It's always a bit of a wild tale. But if the thing is, movies are full of crazy things. Arnold Schwarzenegger was a time traveling robot from the future. Do you know what I mean? It's like, if the film can make you believe it while the film's on, then you're all right. Yeah. And the film made me believe the story while it was on. It built up well. And then it really fucking goes for it with like the gore and the violence, and it absolutely unremittingly kind of, she's got to fight her way out while pregnant. And it was pretty good, actually. The ending is going to be much discussed. Now, I told you the ending off pod. I'm not going to spoil the plot for anybody, but yeah, basically,
it's fucking wild.
This film takes absolutely no prisoners with its ending. And I wonder if why some people, the listener messages that we got, some people really liked it and some people absolutely hated it. I think it's the kind of film that's going to really, you get to that ending and you go, oh, fuck. And as I was watching it, I just thought, are they really going to go all the way with this? Really? And I thought, maybe they'll be like, maybe something will happen that will kind of divert them from where I think this is going. And then it's like, oh no, they're really fucking doing this. And I remember as the lights came up after the thing, other people just getting out of their seats, I was just staring at the screen open mouthed for a couple of minutes after the end. And I think any film that has me like sat with my fucking jaw dropped for a couple of minutes like that has at least done something. Yeah. So it's no classic, but it's kind of, I've got to say, it was a worthwhile hour and a half at the cinema, but I do think some people really hate it. But I don't think they'll hate it because it's a badly made film. It's a well-made film, but there are some creative choices in there which are pretty bold, put it that way. But that was Immaculate. Did that give you time to pick up other things you've seen?
Yeah, sure. I've got my kind of films here. So I tried watching a couple and finished a couple more. So I started The Anatomy of a Fall.
Yeah.
Or is it Anatomy of a Fall? The Anatomy of a Fall.
Yeah.
It seems interesting. Although it's sort of been spoiled for me because I watched the Oscars ITV show, and basically someone on that says you don't really know who did it at the end.
So well, that's kind of a plot spoiler, isn't it?
Yeah. So basically, it's a house, I think, in like Switzerland. It's in the Alps somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And this woman's husband has a fall. And it's all about kind of, did she do it? Was it an accident kind of thing? And that's an interesting concept. It's a very long film for what it is. It's 2.5 hours long. And I've got no problem with that as long as they kind of keep me engaged. I had to turn it off and go do other things. But yeah, I've always kind of been hesitant to put it on, whereas my partner, she was like, oh, I fancy that. So we put it on, but we had to do other things. So
Once you've had a chance to watch the second half, because I haven't watched it yet, but I will. So maybe by this time next month, we'll both have finished it and we can kind of see what we think.
Yeah, but I think, I don't know, like, if that's actually like a deal breaker, the fact that you don't find out who did it, maybe it's the kind of everything in between that's the whole point of it.
Yeah.
Because that wasn't the first time someone had actually told me that. It's just like the kind of most memorable
thing. I heard that the film keeps you guessing. But that's all I knew really.
I tried to watch. I was actually quite excited for this. But it's Next Goal Wins.
Okay.
Waititi, and the trailer looked really good.
I heard mixed reports about this, actually.
Oh, don't you worry. There's nothing mixed about my report. And I thought, I love Taika Waititi, even though his last film was a bit shit. I like Michael Fassbender, and I like kind of like Polynesian like stories and stuff like that. And some mm-hmm. of it is interesting, but I had to put it off. It's not funny at all. The concept is an American soccer football coach comes across from America after being sacked and takes over American Samoa, who are comfortably the worst football team in the world. They are very, very, very bad.
They were like officially ranked, because it's a true story, isn't it? They were officially ranked bottom of all the world, like world's footballing nations.
And that was the trailer, and I was like, cool, I'm on board with that. But it's chronically unfunny. Michael Fassbender is talking in an Irish accent. Now, the real life guy was a Dutch American, so you can't get away with saying, oh, maybe that was just the, you know, that type of accent, because the Irish and Dutch accent are not the same thing. So Michael Fassbender is also a bit weird for that.
Mm.
Have you noticed when he does his accents, it's very much like just his accent? Apart from maybe 12 Years a Slave, where he does sound American, I've always found that he sounds quite Irish. And that's obviously his accent. But yeah, he doesn't make any attempt to sound like an American Dutch football All right. coach. And yeah, the jokes just don't land.
That's a shame.
There's a kind of, Taika Waititi's like this weird kind of prophetic narrator, and I had to turn it off. I didn't even finish it. It was that fucking boring. But sort of after the Oscars, I watched them, some of the kind of Oscar winners again. I actually, my mum was down visiting, so she hadn't seen Oppenheimer.
And, all right.
She loved it, and great to watch it again, and watched Barbie again. She hadn't seen that either, and she also loved it. So yeah. A few films this month. A few films I'd already seen, but
yeah,
that was the stuff I saw. That wasn't like the kind of, you know, features or the kind of, you know, projects that we do. So
yeah. Okay. Well, I watched a few things on streaming to make up for the fact that I only really managed to go to one film at the cinema. So, like I mentioned, I did watch the remake of Roadhouse.
Oh dear.
And the thing is, I didn't want to watch it. I thought this is going to be crap. I thought maybe we'd save it for a future remake hate watch. But I just thought, well, look, it's a new film. It's out, and I'm not getting out to the cinema. And it is being discussed because it was being heavily like trailed on Prime. People were discussing it. I thought, okay, well, joining the conversation, let's watch it. It's kind of weird that it's been directed by Doug Liman, him of The Bourne Identity and Edge of Tomorrow. It's like,
oh, what?
It's like the first. Do you know the name of the director of the original Roadhouse film?
No.
He is the most perfectly named person to direct Roadhouse. His name was Rowdy Harrington.
Yeah.
You see, everything in the original Roadhouse was like Patrick Swayze was going, you know what? I've done Dirty Dancing. I'm about to do Ghost. Before I do that, Let's just fucking smash some shit up. Do you know what I mean? And everyone's just having a good time. It's a very silly film, and that's okay. And it's really weird because for about 45 minutes, it's like they're trying to do a more credible version of the original film. There is a guy in there, and I'm going to have to get his name because he's a funny guy. He was in Narcos, and I've seen him in a couple of things. And he is, he plays a kind of slightly amiable henchman for the bad guy, which is quite funny. Let me get his name for you. You'd recognise him if you saw him. Arturo Castro. Look him up. You know him. He's quite funny. And Jake Gyllenhaal is, like, he's never bad, right? But otherwise, I'm just thinking, why are they taking this story seriously? What's going on? It's Roadhouse. And then Conor McGregor shows up for no reason, just walking around naked and then beating people up and stealing their clothes and then wearing their clothes. And I don't think it's possible to underestimate. We can close the book now. I'd be amazed if anyone else wins Best Acting Performance at the next Double Reel Awards, okay? Because he is absolutely fucking terrible. It looks like he dropped acid and imagined he was Seamus in Harry Potter. It's absolutely terrible. And his acting, his character, the character he's developed, is to have the same stupid grin on his face the whole time. That's it. He is absolutely, absolutely terrible. But then what you have is, it's not like after 45 minutes they go, oh, we remembered we're meant to be sort of having fun and knocking shit about. You have half the movie still trying to be this like credible Doug Liman directed version of Roadhouse. And the other half of the movie is absolute nonsense with Conor McGregor in it. I just think, you know... And it's like, you know, we talk about some films are sacrosanct and should never be remade. Imagine if in 20 years' time someone tries to do a remake of Inception. I think we would both be up in arms, right? It's just, the thing is, Roadhouse shouldn't be remade because they only barely got away with it the first time. And it's like, if you make Roadhouse and it's exactly like the original, why did you bother? And if you make Roadhouse and it's different from the original, why did you bother, you know? So it's completely redundant. So it's a lot of time and money spent for no benefit. I just, honestly, it's the one thing that I found really weird is that it's set in Florida and it's overcast the whole time. Because you know Doug Liman's films have always got that slightly cloudy look to them, like The Bourne Identity, and that really works for like a spy thriller set in Europe.
Yeah.
But this is Florida and the sun's never shining or hardly shining. It's weird. Honestly, I watched it so that I'd have something to talk about on the pod, and even then I felt like it was a waste of time.
Fuck's sake, man.
And I watched The Beekeeper.
Oh, dear.
Look, save everybody's time on this. The Beekeeper is 90% of The Beekeeper is exactly what you expect and want from a Jason Statham film. And I don't mean the bigger films that he's in, like that he's one of the big actors in, but not the actor, like the Fast and Furious franchise. It's, you know, Jason Statham is the main character. He's a guy with a past. And he's usually playing an American film. He's got a British accent and it's like, okay, carry on. And he kicks some people's asses. And at the end, he's kicked a few more people's asses. And you've whiled away an hour and a half, ideally with a couple of beers, and everyone's happy. Yeah? 90% of the film is exactly that. And it's fine. And you'll get exactly what you want from your usual Jason Statham. There's a couple of things that are notable about it. It's directed by David Ayer, he of Fury.
Okay.
But the interesting about David Ayer is that apart from Fury, this is probably his level. If you look at the other films he's done, he's the film equivalent of one of those like football strikers who has one good season in the top flight, and someone spends silly money on him only to realise he was only ever Championship quality. Do you remember Andrew Johnson at Palace?
Yes.
David Ayer is the Andrew Johnson of film directors. He's like
more or less bald than Andrew Johnson.
I couldn't tell you. I could look him up. But obviously Jason Statham films before have had a gimmick. Like Crank, but this gimmick is really weird. He's a former member of a secret CIA assassin team called the Beekeepers. The idea is they are completely selfless and their job is to protect the hive at all costs by killing threats, yeah? But they take this so far that Jason Statham is unable to say anything or respond to any situation without a metaphor or analogy about bees. Everything he says is some sort of analogy about, yes, You got to smoke out the hornets from time to time, or you know, it's like sometimes you're going to get stung, and it's like, what's going on? This is like some like weird autistic man who's obsessed with bees, and then everyone else who's the actual beekeepers come to kill him, and they're all mad about beekeeping as well. So what is going on? Why is and he actually keeps bees? What the fuck is this? And it's almost I'm still not sure how seriously meant to take it. Now, I'm going to spoil the plot here, so spin on a couple of minutes if the plot of Jason Statham films matter to you. I can't imagine that's true, but if so, spin on. The inciting incident of the story is that Jason Statham's only friend in the film is an elderly lady who's renting him her barn so he can keep bees somewhere. She gets her money stolen by a phone scam operation, loads of money, including a charity that she was looking after, and she's so mortified by this that she kills herself, and that's why he decides to come out of retirement and take revenge. The thing is, this phone scam turns out to be a major criminal enterprise that's stealing millions and millions. It's all over America, and it's misusing government software under the guise of being a computer corporation. It's everywhere, and huge amounts of effort is being made to protect this corporation because the guy who runs the corporation is the son of the President of the United States. And the President of the United States and becomes a character in the story. And it's just like, are you fucking mad? Surely you do like a minor congressman or senator for that story, but they've got the president. And it's like, now Jason Statham's going to walk in and start shooting people. Do you realize how well protected the president is? This is just insane and stupid. And I don't know. It's like they try and explain at the beginning why Jason Statham hasn't got a convincing American accent when nobody cares. But what that does is that Jeremy Irons is in it and he's meant to be playing an American actor. And I think he realized that if he does a convincing American accent, it's going to make Statham look bad. So he doesn't bother to do an accent properly either. And then there's a bloke who's meant to be South African and he does a terrible South African accent. It's almost like, you know, when Madonna won't hire backing singers that are better looking than she is. It's just like 90% of this is just completely standard Jason Statham blowing shit up. And then 10% of it is, what are they doing? And I still don't know if it's meant to be serious or not. But honestly, it's Jason Statham. It's quite funny and it's available to watch streaming. So get it in. Now, a final little bit of the films that we watched this month, I thought it'd be quite fun to do a Jamie B. Chambers double bill. So Jamie B. Chambers, friend of the pod, actor, stunt coordinator, sometime producer of films. He came on a couple of years ago to promote Morris Men that had just been completed and was going to festivals. And he came on last year to promote I Am Rage, which was a new film that came straight to streaming. And again, because I was looking around for things to watch, I found a couple of films with him in that have just come out.
Very good.
The first one is Shamrock Spitfire. I don't know if you've heard of this.
I have heard of that.
Yes. I mean, it's had a bit of attention because it was filmed in like Warwickshire. So it was on BBC West Midlands. They're filming a new war film locally. Isn't that interesting? And it's about a real guy, a guy called Brendan Finucane, who nicknamed Paddy because he was Irish and everyone in England in the 1940s were hilarious. Is a young Irishman who always dreamed of being a pilot. So when his family moved to England, he joined the RAF just in time for World War II. He became a renowned fighter ace with over 30 dogfight victories. And at 21 years old, became the youngest wing commander in the history of the Air Force. Wow. So they decided to do a film about him. It's a very low budget film about him. It's very heavily dependent on cheap CGI for like the aerial combat scenes. And it also like reuses an old movie called The Battle of Britain, an old Michael Caine film from the 60s. And you can see the join on all of that. But it's fine. It's very standard stuff. It's got lots of classic war film cliches straight out of the 1950s. And apart from the fact that it's in colour, basically, this could have been made in the 1950s. It's got lots of stiff upper lip. You've got the bit where an officer looks up at the planes flying overhead with an approving smile. A kid waving his model plane around as he watches his hero fly past. Where's my lucky lighter? One of the pilots loses his lucky lighter just before a mission. It's got all of that, right? But it's fine. I mean, it's good. It got a fair write-up in the national press, and it's you have to kind of set your expectations that it's quite cheap. It's not really got very many any well-known actors in it. The main actor, Shane O'Regan, is pretty decent as the main character. It's all right, and I think it is, you know, it works. It's got a beginning, a middle, and an end. It works as a movie, and you kind of have to forgive the special effects a little bit because you know what? This is a really low budget film and an end product versus money spent. It's still being better than most blockbusters, but it's okay. Jamie B. Chambers, our friend on the pod, he is, he's not in it for long. He's playing a real life character, another fighter ace, a Canadian pilot called Butch Aikman. The thing is, he doesn't get a lot to do in the story because the main part of the story is Finucane leading an Australian squadron, which is the main part of it. But in order to cover all the events of his flying career, they have to do the bit at the end where he gets transferred into looking after a Canadian squadron. So you only get Jamie at the end very briefly. He's in some pivotal scenes, and I get the feeling he was cast in this part because they weren't short of people who could do Australian accents, but only Jamie could do a Canadian one. So they've given him that part kind of thing. He adds a little bit of flair. He does a solid job. He doesn't get a lot to do, but it's nice to see Jamie in a movie, right? You can see that he's trying to just give a little bit of extra flair to his character because he's got the big flying jacket on and he's kind of the centre of the shot when they've got like a couple of briefings. But honestly, it's not a Jamie B. Chambers film, but obviously he's in it because he's, you know, he plays a part. So I watched it because he was in it mostly. Do you know what I mean? Just because, you know, friend of the pod is on it. But yeah, it's fine. It doesn't let the side down for what it is. And the other part of the double bill that I watched was, drum roll please, Morris Men is finally out to watch on video on demand view. Ooh,
very good.
It's still you've got to pay to rent it, so set your expectations. Now you will note in the last time Jamie came on the pod and we asked him, you know, it's been over a year. When do you think we'll see Morris Men? And he did say that the writer and director had had to go back to the drawing board a little bit and kind of re-edit what they had, because I don't think they quite got what they hoped to get in the filming. So kind of set your expectations on that. But Jamie has a much more prominent role in this. He plays Tommy, a sort of a traumatized war veteran who's going back to his hometown, trying to kind of reconcile with his old girlfriend. And it turns out she's part of a Morris dancing troupe who are secretly vigilantes clearing out organized crime, which is potentially a lot of fun as a storyline. You can see the join a bit with the reworking they decided to do. They used the footage of the bad guy drinking from a whiskey decanter and getting angry at least twice, because I think what's happened is that they've looked at it and gone, oh, we don't quite have all the scenes that we need. We're going to have to kind of monkey around with this a bit. So Jamie is very solid. I think he's comfortably the best actor in the film, put it that way. Other people are good at bits and pieces. It's okay. It's quite fun. I don't think they quite delivered on the potentially interesting idea. I think they had script problems, because you know in a film like that you want the save the cat scene at the beginning where the Morris men come in and kick some ass and you work out who they are and then you get the main story. Do you know what I mean? And then you kind of have the plot build up and it gets increasingly kind of serious and the bad guy starts taking casualties and all right, and it builds to a climax. And I think filming with COVID on very low budget, I don't think they quite got all of it. But it's quite good. It's got some good fight scenes because Jamie was a fight choreographer and they were doing some serious martial arts fighting. But I don't think the script and direction are up to it. But, you know, out of loyalty to Jamie and because he took the trouble to come and promote the movie, I went to watch it. And it's okay, and it's good for Jamie's fight scenes. He's good. I don't think the rest of the film stands up as well as it might have done. And I think the fact they spent an extra year like re-editing it probably suggests that that's where they had their problems.
Yeah.
But, you know, listen, anyone who goes to the trouble of making a movie on those kinds of resources deserves a pat on the back, you know. But also, it's a lesson. Screenwriting is structure, as William Goldman said. You've got to get your structure right. And I think then, maybe they didn't quite get that right. But yeah, fair play to Morris Men, and it's always nice to see and hear from Jamie. That takes us through all of the films we've watched this month. That's our movie watching for the month, apart from our resolutions. Now, we both have a New Year's resolution for the year. Why don't we do yours first? What is your resolution and what is your film for this month?
So it is the Year of the Nolan. So self-explanatory, I'm watching all of Christopher Nolan's films.
Now that he's directed 12 of them.
Now that he's directed 12 of them. And I haven't really come up with a structure. So I've done, what have I done so far? I did Dunkirk, didn't I?
Yes, you did.
I did Dunkirk and I did Batman Begins in the same month. And then last month I did Dark Knight Rises.
Yeah.
And I just said last month I'd finish off the Dark Knight trilogy. So I watched The Dark Knight.
Yeah. Now, it seems redundant to ask you, did you like it? I think it's probably fairly safe to say you liked
it. The 14th time I've watched it, turns out I hate it. No. Yeah. Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. I think watching it again after, it's probably been a good few years since I've watched it.
Hmm.
And I think that it had become one of those films for me where if I was to watch it every year, you know what I mean, like make it a thing, it wouldn't be as fun. So I'm glad I've left it a good few years.
Mm-hmm.
It is just masterful. And I kind of hate the perception that the film has that it's not that good. Like realistically, it's just a Batman film, because it isn't. It's so much more than that. You know, the opening heist is nothing like I've ever seen in like any heist films. Like I've never seen anything as interesting as that in any Ocean's 11 film,
mm-hmm.
in anything like that. And that's not even a big part of the film. That's like fucking 6 minutes at the start of the film.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's kind of like what Nolan's done there is that he's done three Batman films, but each one of them wasn't just a Batman film. You know, The Dark Knight is something of a heist movie. Batman Begins had a different spin, and Dark Knight Rises was almost like about like the political revolution sort of taking over a city, you know, city under siege. So he always does something different with it. And that's why Matt Reeves I think he learned a good lesson from that, is don't do it like Nolan did it, but do what Nolan did, which is make your Batman some other kind of film, because Matt Reeves made his a ground level detective story, which it's that nice balance of true to what Batman is and can be, but also your own movie. And Nolan perfected that, didn't he?
Yeah, I mean it's brilliant. It obviously would not be the same film without Heath Ledger's performance as the Joker, which to the day I die I will say is the best performance I've ever seen in a film ever. Joaquin Phoenix's Joker doesn't have a patch on Heath Ledger's, and he's still brilliant in Joker. So,
I remember being skeptical about Heath Ledger when they announced he'd been cast. I was like, "What, really?" And yeah, could not have been more wrong.
Yeah, it's just superb. I think you're just captivated by every line, just everything that he says and does, and just the kind of sheer chaos of the character. I don't think we'll ever see a performance like that, ever. You know, I don't know if you think anyone's capable of pulling a performance like that, but I don't think we'll ever see anything like Heath Ledger. I mean, it obviously took its toll on him, and it really affected him, and I think it did contribute to his death, because he took it so seriously, and it really fucked up his sort of like sleep schedule, and just his he was absolutely exhausted after the role. But
I remember Jack Nicholson saying that. I think he said he actually tried to contact Heath Ledger after filming, and based on his own experiences. And Jack Nicholson didn't do anything quite as immersive as that. But he said even he, like, took some time off after playing the Joker.
Yeah.
And I think maybe Heath Ledger, because he was straight from that to doing two other films almost back to back.
Dr. Parnassus, yeah.
And another one which I can't quite remember which it was. And it's like maybe he should have gone on holiday for a month and to just decompress. I don't know.
Yeah, it's a real shame, but it will be my favorite performance of all time. It's strange that he does all these horrible things, but you still kind of root for him, because you know he's taken out on some really nasty people. You know the mob, these wannabe gangsters, the corrupt, you know, people in Gotham. And he almost wants to be friends with Batman in a way. He loves the kind of competition and the fight that they have between each other. You know, he doesn't like when he says, "I don't want to kill you," like, you completely,
you're too much fun.
Yeah. And it's strange, because it's interesting that he wouldn't want to, you know, target, you know Batman and even people like Commissioner Gordon, because Commissioner Gordon is a good man. It's weird that, you know, you almost root for the Joker. Obviously, with performances like that, you almost end up rooting for the villain anyway when it's entertaining and it's
captivated by it. If he gets caught or killed, then the fun's over for the audience, basically, isn't it?
But when you look at it, when he does the "why so serious" stuff, you know, apart from the Maggie Gyllenhaal one, but I don't think he would ever have done, you know, when he speaks to Gamble and he puts like the blade in his mouth and kills him. You know, you'd never see him do that to anyone that didn't really deserve it. And just the kind of, just even like the scene with the two ferries, you know, one's full of civilians and one's full of
I mean, obviously there's a lot of this kind of thing to kind of draw on from the stories, but Nolan was very good, and obviously he gets involved in the writing of his films. So I don't know if that was that him and his brother on that one, but anyway,
I don't think he
would have been part of the writing anyway. But he's very good at building these scenarios where people have to make a choice. That's what it comes down to, isn't it? It's like the Maggie Gyllenhaal thing is, because Batman has to make a choice, he feels responsible for Rachel's death. But it's not him who, like, wired her up to the explosive in the oil drums, you know? And then the same with the ferries. It's like he makes people make a choice. You got to push a button or not push a button, and life or death depends on it. And it's always fascinating to watch, isn't it?
Yeah. Jonathan Nolan definitely wrote The Dark Knight. It was, you know, co-wrote it. But I don't think he's actually done a film with Christopher Nolan since Interstellar.
No.
He's just sort of done his own thing. But yeah, brilliant film. Can't speak more highly of it. And that was my entry for April.
Very good. Year of the Nolan. Very good. So my resolution is that I just decided at the beginning of the year I was going to watch more films by female directors. No real reason for that other than And I said this before, when you, I do default to genre films, and you know, probably I watch more older films than newer films. You look at my Letterboxd, but at the same time, I'm open to watching more films by women directors. But if I'm going back to watching a film from the 80s, I bet a woman didn't direct it, kind of thing. Or if I'm going to watch a crime drama or some little science fiction, some of these other films that are like, there are fewer women represented there. So I just said, look, if I pick 12 films on the basis that they're directed by a woman, I will find 12 films that I've not watched before. That's what it comes down to. And this podcast is always about encouraging you to watch something a little bit different from the usual that you normally watch, because it's better that way. And this month, it just happened to come up, although it's interesting, you know, I did this like schedule kind of last year, actually. But the next film on the list is Lady Bird, directed by Greta Gerwig, who is obviously, you know, something of the woman of the hour, because Barbie was big in awards season and everything else, and she made the biggest film last year. Lady Bird's basically a coming-of-age drama about a teenage character who's somewhat precocious and looking to kind of do something, you know, different with her life. And she goes through various rites of passage in a small town that tells you something about her and the other characters. This kind of thing, not normally my genre, but that's not because of films like Lady Bird. It's because of films in this genre that aren't made by people as talented as Greta Gerwig, if I'm completely honest. But you know what I'm talking about. You will see, yeah, you will see the poster, and the people will be in the same poses, and they'll be like the emblem of one of the more independent film festivals, and lots of kind of quotes of what a great film this is, and you'll go, that's an indie coming-of-age drama. Do I want to go and see it? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And look, someone else is probably right now saying exactly the same thing about heist movies or hitman movies that I love. Do you know what I mean? If it's not your genre, like musicals. I know how much, you know, skill and thought goes into musicals. It's just not my thing, right? So yeah. no offense. But obviously, if Greta Gerwig's doing it, it might be good, right? And the cast is really good. Saoirse Ronan, Laurie Metcalf, Timothée Chalamet, Lucas Hedges. These are all strong performers. The rest of the cast is made up of people you'd recognize if you saw them. It's well written because Greta Gerwig's a really good writer. I mean, the story is basically Lady Bird is a name that Saoirse Ronan's character has given herself. She doesn't like her given name, Christine. She has a really fraught relationship with her mother, who had a really bad relationship with her own mum. She's got artistic pretensions. She lives in the suburbs of Sacramento, and she wants to go to the big city to be a writer and performer. If you see Derry Girls and look at the Erin character, it's similar. You kind of see, it's like there's a slightly comic take on what a pretentious, you know, it's Greta Gerwig's been quite autobiographical here and going, what a pretentious teenager I was, you know? But I have to say, I did really enjoy this, partly because it's got some nice stuff in there about how Lady Bird is always kind of trying to get away from Sacramento and seems a bit like tired of the place. She doesn't want to live in the suburbs of like a nowhere city. And yet she can't help showing an underlying love for the place. The relationship with the mother is really well drawn. There's a really nice scene where they just start absolutely screaming at each other. And it's one of those relationships where they have an argument and everything they've ever done to piss each other off comes out immediately. So you did this, you did that. And they say really unkind things to each other, but they're dress shopping. And they just stop the argument because a mum finds a nice outfit and they just forget the argument and talk about the dress. And you go, yeah, I totally recognise those people, you know?
Yeah.
And it's really well edited as well. These rites of passage, they tend to be quite low budget films and they tend to be based on kind of everyday things that people do. You know, there are no car chases or, you know, alien invasions, right? So it's all about people. What happens if they go to school? There's a big audition for the school play. More everyday events take place. And what makes it work is how you edit it together and show the passage of time. And this is really well edited. I don't know how much is the writing. I don't know how much is the editing. But it's just, it's really nice the way it shows the different events and incidents in her life. And it really takes you somewhere. It's just really well done. Greta Gerwig is a skilled filmmaker who's done exactly what you're supposed to do with this. Because sometimes they talk about indie dramas and coming of age things and that sort of thing versus genre films, but actually everything's a genre. And the indie coming of age drama is a genre of film, right? There are certain tropes that happen every time. But what she's done is she's used this to do a really nice characterization of the different characters in the movie. And it's really well written. Laurie Metcalf as the mum is a really warm person. She's a really nice person. And yet she and her daughter are completely at each other's throats and say some really unkind things to each other. It's just really believable, really well done. And despite it being quite an it's not a melodramatic, you know, there's no, you know, explosions. There's no kind of, you know, spoiler alert, but there's not a lot of like death and destruction in the movie, but it makes you care about the characters, and it takes the story in a direction and delivers the goods, because Greta Gerwig is really good. So it hasn't converted me necessarily to this genre of movie, but it's just confirmed what I already knew, which is the next thing that Greta Gerwig does, I'll probably watch, because she's very good. The only criticism I have maybe is that I'm not sure about the ending. I felt like it kept going a little bit after it was done, because okay. it's got a good 10 minutes at the end where she's goes to university after graduating high school, and I thought, I'm not sure. I think I can see why it's in, because I think it's about, I think the film's all about growing up and the added perspective you get, you know, when you look back on your teenage years. So I understand, but I felt like the film lost a little bit of momentum then. Maybe that could have been an epilogue, but far be it from me to criticise Greta Gerwig, who doesn't seem to be able to put a foot wrong from the films I've seen of hers, right? So fair play to Greta Gerwig, good movie. Hasn't quite converted me to you know, this genre of movie completely, but it's good. It's any genre is watchable if a really talented filmmaker's doing it, yeah? Have you seen Lady Bird?
I haven't, no. I've always sort of wanted to, but I've never actually, I don't know why I've never got around to it, do you know what I mean? Like, I don't know if it's just not been like on streaming, and or I've just not maybe thought, oh, I've always wanted to see that, and then just forgot to look for it the next time I'm on, you know, on my telly looking for something to watch.
It's a really well-made film. I mean, why don't I, like, I'll hop on Just Watch, justwatch.com, or the Just Watch app I use pretty heavily to kind of find the films that I might want to watch. And Lady Bird is, I think you have to pay to watch it at the moment. No, Prime Video. It's free if you've got Prime Video. So worth sticking on.
Very good.
Now, as always, I try and draw some inspiration from the film I've watched for my resolution for an impromptu top 10, which is 10 films that have something in common with the movie I talked about this month. And what I've done here is that even though Sacramento is actually a largish city, this film is set in the suburbs and has a small town feel. And it feels like this is one of those movies about small town life, in the sense that it's got a central character who has a complicated relationship with the place, but the place is something of a character in the movie one way or another. So this impromptu top 10 is like films about small town life, you know, bit varied here. It's a Wonderful Life, To Kill a Mockingbird, Heathers, Doc Hollywood, Local Hero, Stand By Me, Hot Fuzz, Cinema Paradiso, Amarcord, and Lone Star. Quite different set of films there, but they all have something in common that you kind of, you learn something about a small town and the characters who live in them by the time you get to the end of the movie. But that's the end of my resolution for this month. And unless you have anything to add, mate, that's Double Real Monthly for April.
But I don't think so, no.
Very good. Well, thank you very much, mate. Thank you very much for staying with us, audience. That's all for the latest edition of Double Real Monthly. Thanks for listening. Thanks also to my co-host, James Adamson.
The music was Mistake the Getaway by Kevin MacLeod.
Next week, we'll be back with our regular features. First up will be our Classics and Recommended feature, where we finally get around to watching the Orson Welles film noir, Touch of Evil. Then our hidden gem, where we tell you why you should get around to watching Ghost Dog, The Way of the Samurai.
In The Winter Gotaway, we'll tell you about Martin Scorsese's House of Gucci, and in the remake Hate Watch, we look at the uncredited Jaws ripoff Orca. Then a week after that, our big conversation episode will bring you our favourite films of the 2000s.
We look forward to you joining us then. Look after yourselves in the meantime. See you on the other side.